This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. A week from today, a new documentary will premiere on WFYI-1 public television here in Indianapolis. The revolutionist Eugene V. Debs shares the life and legacy of the Terre Haute native, turn-of-the-century labor leader, and five-time socialist presidential candidate. At a time when the idea of socialism is such a major concern among many Americans, we'll look at the definition of that ideology, what it meant then, what it means now, and how many of the labor laws we take for granted might not exist were it not for Eugene Debs. And with this being such a hot topic today, I encourage you to share your questions and comments with our live panel via social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We're going to start with the film's producers, Kyle Travers. Good afternoon, Kyle.
Hi, thanks for having us.
And Kim Hood Jacobs. Thanks for your time today.
Glad to be here.
Kim, why did you want to make this documentary?
I have a friend who put the bug in my ear. He said, "We can do something about Eugene V. Debs." And I said, "Well, you know, it costs a lot of money to do that." He goes, "When do you need it?" And I think you're going to talk to him in a little bit. But he started thinking about talking to me about the correlations between history today, Debs' history, and what we're going through today. And I started to see the correlations between the two times.
Kyle, what's it been like for you digging into all this?
Well, I first kind of got into the history of Eugene Debs during the Bicentennial Project. We did a four-part series about our state's history in 2016 during the Bicentennial. And just wondered why people hadn't heard of this guy. He's so interesting and so influential, and nobody had really done anything about him. So it seemed like the right time and the right person to talk about.
There are a lot of parts and pieces to Eugene Debs' life. What does this film focus on?
I think you could break his life into three major parts. He brought us industrialized unionism. We have Labor Day because of the Poland strike, which he led the ARU, an industrialized union. And then he was the father of American or democratic socialism, which, there were so many factions. If you have a European progenitor in your – if great-grandpa of so-and-so was from Germany, they probably were from a socialist family, and they brought that to the United States. But there were so many different types of socialism, and Eugene Debs brought them all together so that they could function in a democracy with a capital D, if you will. So that's part two. And then part three, you got at World War One, and Kyle's really good at talking about this because they passed the Espionage Act, which made it difficult for anybody to speak out against the war. Debs did, believing that the war was wrong. He went to prison for it. So then we have – that's the third part of Debs. It's intriguing because it's free speech in time of war. What is that in our country where we are guaranteed free speech? So those are the three areas of his life that I think people should know about.
Kim, I love the Indiana aspect of this. I love Indiana history. But up until last year, I had never even heard of Eugene Debs. And I'm kind of finding out, at least to some degree, that that might have been on purpose.
Well, Howard Zinn wrote that they buried him in history. And Kyle, by the way, is a history major from Indiana University, which is – I love working with her because she pushes questions and you're shaking your head just as I'm trying to get you to talk about
that. Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, it's hard to say whether it was officially suppressed, but with the Espionage Act, with the Sedition Act, they were coming about at a time when we were at war, World War One, and also at a time where the Russian Revolution was happening. And so there was this big fear in the United States that revolution would happen here as well. And so there was a concerted effort to suppress, you know, speaking out against the war and any sort of kind of organized protest about labor, because they saw that was related to the Russian Revolution and the people's uprising there. So there was a big effort, a big FBI effort to kind of keep that under wraps. And, you know, people know about the Red Scare, and this is the first Red Scare. This is when it first started happening, was around World War One.
Yeah, we're not talking about McCarthyism in the 50s.
Right.
We're talking about the original Red Scare.
Yes.
And we'll talk to some historians in the next segment, but I want to get some perspectives from you as well. Kim, when we look at Debs' time back in the late 1800s and the early part of last century, there are a lot of parallels to today. Let's look specifically at immigration. What was the political climate like back then when it came to immigration?
We interviewed the senior curator at the African American Smithsonian African American Museum of Art and Culture, and first you have African Americans who are former slaves, and then you have this influx of these ships powered by steam arriving daily, bringing thousands of workers, hundreds of thousands of workers, to work in our factories to manufacture these goods. And they weren't entirely welcome. Debs didn't entirely welcome them, and he had harsh words for them initially, believing they were in competition for Americans' jobs. So that's a parallel, mm-hmm. and.
Yeah, and I think also with the World War I Sedition Act, there was a lot of fear about German immigrants and German citizens. And so there was a lot of fear about their heritage influencing what side of the war they were on. So a lot of people were deported and property was seized. And so, yeah, there was a suspicion of immigrants at that time. It's just a different...
I think it was overwhelming. Kyle, as the co-producer, has been in charge of visuals, you know, the pictures, and she found a video or film of the Palmer raids where they were pulling immigrants physically out of their homes. Mm-hmm. And the first time I saw when after she'd laid that in, I just teared up. It was so automatic because I could just see the people today, the same thing happening today, and it's that correlation was the strongest for me.
You mentioned German immigrants who were at that time in the latter part of the 19th century publishing their own German language newspapers.
Oh,
and
yes.
How was the political system they were used to different from the one in place here in the U.S.?
Well, the German socialists were probably the most traditional socialists. And we should really say something about this. Socialism, there may be – okay, between democracy and communism, maybe there are eight different types of socialism that can be somewhat defined. And that was part of Deb's challenge. These socialists ranged from the anarchists that blew up the Haymarket. They would solve their problems with bombs to the Christian socialists who held weekly book clubs because as education went, they wanted people to know about science and they wanted them to know about – they wanted to be an educated community. So not sure.
So why did German socialists, if they were used to that sort of political system, why did so many of them, and maybe you're not equipped to answer this, but why did so many of them come to America where the political and economic system was so different?
Land,
I wonder.
Jobs, opportunity. And I think it would be a mistake for all of us to think they brought this because this is what they grew up with. But they look to Debs for ways to integrate these ideas. I mean, for Debs, socialism, he basically said, look, and you have to think about it in the context of the times. But he said, our government could do more to improve the lives of our communities. I mean, we need clean water. People who had settled in these cities found them to be filthy dirty. They didn't have sanitary systems. If you wanted fire departments, you had to pay for it. If you wanted police services, these are things we take for granted today, but Eugene Debs says these things we need. Socialism is asking the government to do more for families and communities, like clean water, like no children, like public schools. So it was a different – you can't measure this man in terms of the words that we're bantering around today. Or the superficial definitions that we contrive today when we think of socialism.
Were those ideas that he pushed then that we take for granted now, were they considered radical at the time?
Yeah. Yeah. Think about that. If you wanted fire department to come to your house, you had to actually pay them to do that. So – or if you wanted clean water, I mean, there was a correlation to today too, but
What's the main point then, sure. I guess, that you want people to come away with when they see this film? I mean, is it just a historical – is it just an informative historical film, or does it have that sort of larger point? I mean, obviously,
both.
When as a filmmaker, you want to connect things to the times today.
Yeah, and we debated, you know, how much do we tell people this is what's happening today? Can you see the connections? And we decided to go with more of a straightforward historical documentary and give people the benefit of the doubt that they can make those connections to today's politics and today's society, and not beat them over the head and say, see how this is the same, because it's pretty obvious.
We were delighted. You know, the first person who looked at it immediately saw the correlations to what we're doing. And I think that's probably a sadness is that I'm as guilty of it as anything, but we don't know a lot about our history. So when these things come to us, or when these correlations happen, we sort of sit, that's a really bad thing. But at the time, it was a really good thing. I want people to know that Eugene Debs existed. How many of us sitting in this room or listening to this at home can say, oh, yeah, I know these great industrialists, this Carnegie and Mellon, but who was the leader of the ordinary worker, the ordinary man? Not everybody made it. Not everybody made those millions and millions of dollars.
Kyle, the premiere, like we said, is tomorrow night, and that's the public premiere, and that's at ISU. The broadcast premiere is a week from tonight. Are there any other ways people can see this film?
Yeah, it's actually going to be a part of Heartland Film Festival. And there are two screenings. There's one October 11th at 5 p.m. and then one on Sunday, October 13th at 7:20. And then you can look in their on their website and in their guide to get more details. But, yeah, we're really excited to be part of Heartland Film Festival.
The documentary is The Revolutionist, Eugene V. Debs, and its public premiere is tomorrow night at University Hall Theater in Terre Haute. Its broadcast premiere is a week from tonight on WFYI-1 here in Indianapolis. Producer Kyle Travers, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
And producer Kim Hood Jacobs, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, a closer look at the life of Eugene V. Debs from two historians, University of Tennessee Knoxville Professor Ernest Freeberg and IU Professor Emeritus Jim Madison. Of course, we'll take your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our show on Eugene Debs, the subject of a new WFYI documentary, a quick correction from Tuesday's News Roundup show. In our discussion about the UAW strike against GM, we said workers at suppliers were not UAW members and had quit after their companies ended production. This was incorrect. Many employees at suppliers are members of the UAW, and those we talked with were laid off and said some left for other jobs. We regret the error. But it does segue quite well back into today's discussion on Terre Haute native and turn-of-the-century labor leader and presidential candidate Eugene V. Debs, who is the subject of the new documentary that premieres tomorrow night on the ISU campus. Joining us by phone to share some history is IU Professor Emeritus and author of The Indiana Way and Hoosiers, A New History of Indiana, Jim Madison. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good to be here, Matt.
And via Skype is professor of history at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and author of Democracy's Prisoner, Eugene V. Debs, The Great War and the Right to Dissent, Ernest Freeberg. Thanks for your time.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Of course, we encourage you to share your questions and comments now on social media. What do you want to know about Eugene V. Debs? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Ernest Freeberg, your book is about the latter part of Debs' life, which is a big piece, maybe the biggest when it comes to historical significance. But can you give me a quick overview of what led to his fame and national platform?
Well, Debs began as a union organizer working for the American Railway Union in the center of the Pullman strike, the largest, most important strike in the 19th century. And it's that strike that led him to prison, 6 months stay in the Woodstock, Illinois penitentiary. And it's there, I think, that he began to realize that the system was rigged against working people, against labor, and that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans were going to come to the aid of working people, and that they needed to form an independent political party, which became the Socialist Party. So at least as the story goes, he was given a copy of Das Kapital while sitting in Woodstock jail, and emerged out of it determined to do his part in establishing the Socialist Party, which really gave a political voice to labor, to working people through the first 2 decades of the 20th century.
And I want to come back to the Pullman strike. Jim Madison, Eugene Debs led the American Railway Union, which in 1894 launched that boycott, which led to the Pullman strike, which was a pivotal moment for workers' rights. Can you just tell us about the Pullman strike?
Sure. Well, I think we have to start with Debs himself as a railroad worker. He grew up in Terre Haute in an immigrant family. He left school at age 14 and went to work on the railroad. And Terre Haute was a huge railroad town in those days. And he eventually worked his way up to a fireman. Very difficult, dangerous work. And he understood that work. He understood the conditions of labor, not only on the railroad, but across America. And this was a time when workers had very, very few rights, where they worked very, very long hours, 12 hours a day, 6-7 days a week, as did Debs as a young kid on the railroad. And so he understood labor, and he became increasingly committed to organizing labor, organizing workers, so that they could have a larger voice in the conflicts between labor and capital. And that's the context in which, when the Pullman workers go on strike at the company in Chicago, Debs, with his newly created American Railway Union, joins that strike, and it becomes, as Professor Freeberg says, one of the great labor strikes in all of American history. And it's very important for labor history then, but also important for Debs and his career and his changes that come after 1894.
And indeed, it, as we said earlier in the program, it led to the to Labor Day. We wouldn't have Labor Day were it not for the Pullman strike. And Professor Freeberg, in the years following the strike, Debs' political momentum really picked up. What led to him running for president the first time in 1900?
Well, a successful political party, and especially a third party in our system, really requires a coalition. And so Debs, I think what made him so important was that he was able to speak to such a wide range of people who were socialists. So this would include the Jewish garment workers in Manhattan and the Midwestern socialists in places like Milwaukee and Chicago and the Bohemian radicals in San Francisco or Greenwich Village, the populist farmers in Tennessee, Texas, Oklahoma, those sorts of places. Debs was able to really speak to all of those groups, and he did so by translating socialist doctrine into something that was a very distinctively American product. I think he was himself very steeped in American history, deeply admired the anti-slavery movement. Wendell Phillips, John Brown was a personal hero, Walt Whitman. And so he was able to create a kind of socialism, a message about it that spoke to all those different groups, and also spoke more broadly, I think, synthesized that into what would, you know, be a uniquely American brand of socialism.
That's kind of a feat to bring that diverse of a crowd under one umbrella. You mentioned all the different types of people. Was that as much of a feat then as it seems like it would be now?
Oh, it certainly was. And a lot of it had to do with his charisma. I mean, he was a remarkably generous person and a tremendous speaker at a time when other speakers, I mean, there were many great speakers in the speech makers in the 19th century, but Debs was really considered to be one of the very best. And he could hold an audience for 2 or 3 hours. He also was a great campaigner. He would head off every 4 years in his train, the Red Special, and do, you know, just exhaust himself. He pushed himself very often to the point of complete collapse. Out on the road giving speeches from the back of his Red Special train.
He ran for president 5 times in total, gaining more and more votes each time until 1912. He got a whopping 6% of the popular vote. This was before women were given the right to vote. And that's an awful lot for a third party candidate, right?
Yeah, it certainly is. He was starting to make the mainstream parties quite nervous. Teddy Roosevelt called him an apostle of bloodshed, anarchy, and riot, and warned that, and really a lot of what became the Bull Moose progressive platform, Roosevelt said, look, Debs and his movement, they're growing in power every year. If we don't take some of the good ideas that they have and translate them into the political system, we're going to face a revolution.
Well, what were some of those good ideas that they adopted?
Well, Kim was in the earlier segment was talking a bit about that. I think that a lot of the things that we think of as the normal social safety network were radical ideas that became part of the progressive platform in this period. So workers' protections, pensions, more support for public schools, municipal ownership of utilities, just a wide range of programs. It was, you know, there was a branch of socialism that tended to be called sewer socialism, because there were people who said, really, what we're doing here is not overthrowing capitalism. What we're trying to do is show that a collaborative social approach to government can provide a better product for people. And we're going to run Milwaukee and Schenectady and other places more efficiently than the private market can.
In a lot of ways, as we've mentioned, his popularity was a big threat to the two-party system at the time. But World War I changed that. Let's talk about his imprisonment. Ernest, what got him thrown in jail in 1918?
The Socialist Party was the most powerful voice in opposing U.S. involvement in the war. You know, when the war broke out in 1914, most Americans were not in favor of getting involved in the war. But by 1917, when Wilson declared war, it still was an enormously unpopular war. Immigrant groups, isolationists in the South and in the Midwest were not interested in getting in the war. But the Socialist Party was met 3 days after the Congressional Declaration of War. They met in St. Louis, and they declared that they were going to work against participation in the war and work against participation in the draft because they felt this was a capitalist war, a rich man's war and a poor man's fight, as the saying goes. So Debs was just one of many hundreds of speakers, socialists, but also Christian pacifists of various kinds, and sometimes just people who were spouting off at a bar or a local gathering, who ended up getting arrested by under a new federal law, the Espionage Act of 1917, that made it illegal to try to, what it made it illegal to do is a little unclear, but the government used it in order to crack down on dissent in a very severe way.
And he indeed made his final bid for president in 1920 from his prison cell, having been there for quite some time. And he actually got more votes than when he ran in 1912, though the percentage of the popular vote was lower. Obviously, now by that time, women had finally gotten the right to vote, which changed the numbers a little bit. Did women turn out for Debs?
No, I think the women's vote didn't change the formula that way at all. There certainly were a number of women involved in the in the women's suffrage movement who were socialists or supporters of the socialist cause. But no, I don't think that he got a particularly, not that I've ever seen a breakdown of the vote by gender, it being a secret ballot, but I don't think there was any particular women's vote for Debs in 1920.
Jim Madison, let's bring the focus back home. In many ways, Eugene V. Debs was and remains a controversial figure. Are there ways Indiana has deliberately not honored or recognized him in the past?
Well, I don't think deliberate so much as just not caring. And sometimes that's worse than deliberate. But I think Indiana has not cared enough about Gene Debs in all sorts of ways and all sorts of pieces of evidence. Like the sleeping dog that does not bark in the night. Look around. Where are the monuments, memorials to Debs across our state? There are a few, but not nearly enough. I personally think that Eugene V. Debs is one of the two or three greatest Hoosiers who's ever lived. Whether you agree or disagree with his ideas and his policies, he was a truly great man. And I want to go back to something you were talking about earlier, and that is Debs's character, his charisma, his speaking ability, but also the kind of person he was. And I have a great source for this. It's the Indiana poet James Whitcomb Riley, who is honored, greatly honored in our state, and deservedly so. But Riley wrote about Debs, and they were very good friends. They were drinking buddies, actually, incongruous friends. But here's what Riley wrote about Debs, and it's in dialect, which I don't do very well, but he wrote, "And there's Gene Debs, a man that stands and just holds out in his two hands as warm a heart as ever beat, twixt here and the judgment seat." Debs was a nice guy. He was, in some ways, a nice Hoosier guy. In the context of all this agitation for labor and socialism and against capitalism, we have a very, very interesting fellow here.
Well, and yeah, his politics are divisive even today. The mere use of the word socialism concerns a lot of people these days. But you say, regardless of his politics, he should be recognized and remembered for his contributions to the world today.
Absolutely. Most of the ideas that he proposed in terms of socialism in the early 20th century, we've enacted. We now have city-owned utilities. We have women's suffrage. We have had tax reform of one sort or the other. So they were a little radical at the time, but we've accepted them over the long course of our history.
Professor Freeburg, do you want to speak to any of that? Is there anything you have to add to that list of his contributions that are still in effect today?
I think it's worth, I agree completely with what Jim is saying. I would add, and I think this is important, and I think it fits into the theme of a film called The Revolutionist, is that Debs was not simply a progressive reformer. I mean, we have to understand the world that he lived in and the way the systems appeared to be and was rigged against working people. Debs had a real faith in the power of the ballot box and felt that if American working people who were in the majority would actually realize how to vote in their own self-interest, that they would vote out the two political parties that were supporting the capitalist system, and they would vote in something drastically different. And it's important to remember that was a serious, real threat. Debs was considered to be a dangerous man by the powers that be in the 19-teens, and he thought so too. And he thought there was a reason to be dangerous, you know, that the world needed drastic structural change. And a lot of what, you know, as I was suggesting earlier, I think a lot of good ideas, progressive ideas from that movement were absorbed. But the fundamental question about the way the capitalist system influences the political system, I think, is very much still with us. You know, and the issues about whether or not people are clear to vote their own self-interest at the ballot box, whether they recognize what that is, I think that's still very much part of our national conversation.
Yeah.
Add another context there, Matt, please. I think we spend a lot of time studying the mainstream in the middle of the road, and in Indiana especially we do that. We don't like agitators. We like moderation, even conservative approaches to things. But I think we also learn a lot by studying and thinking about those who are outside of the mainstream, on the edge, challenging the status quo. And Debs is a wonderful example of that. And then secondly, what's on the outside 100 years or 200 years ago sometimes moves into the mainstream, into the middle. And in some ways, that's the case with some of Debs, not all of it. There still is very much today, I think, a revolutionary side there. And I think we ought to pay attention to that. Reject it, accept it, revise it, but you can't just ignore it, as Indiana has tended to do with Gene Debs.
And in the last minute that we have, we've talked about how some of the issues that he brought forth in his time were considered radical but are now commonplace. Are there any things that he talked about then that are still radical today and sort of inform the issues that we're grappling with now? Professor Freeburg, you can chime in on that.
Well, I'd say that he's essentially, I mean, those like Bernie Sanders, who consider themselves to be a socialist who admires Debs, are really not socialists in the Debsian terms. He was arguing for shared public ownership of the means of production, which is a far more radical reform or revolutionary idea than anybody who's been labeled a socialist in the current landscape. So if we want to sort of consider the full spectrum of political ideas in American 20th century politics, we need to recognize that the socialism is often a label that's not very precisely used, and mostly used in order to as a pejorative.
I want to thank you both so much for your time today, Professor Emeritus of History at IU and author of Hoosiers: A New History of Indiana, Jim Madison. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Ernest Freeburg, professor of history at University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and author of Democracy's Prisoner, Eugene V. Debs, The Great War, and The Right to Dissent. Ernest, thank you for coming on.
Thank you, and I look forward to seeing The Revolutionist.
Up next, a look at the present-day legacy of Eugene V. Debs with President Emeritus of the Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Union, Michael Sullivan, and former Terre Haute Mayor Fred Nation. And, of course, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're talking about the life and legacy of Eugene Debs on the eve of the public premiere of the WFYI documentary, The Revolutionist, Eugene V. Debs. And now we're going to look at the modern legacy of Debs and how he helped to shape labor laws that are still in effect today. And, of course, we'll take your questions and comments for our panel on social media. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We're joined on the phone now by former Terre Haute mayoral candidate Fred Nation. Good afternoon, Fred.
Good afternoon.
And I was just informed that you were not actually the mayor. You were just a mayoral candidate.
That's correct. Similar to Gene Debs, I lost.
but that's okay. And in the studio is President Emeritus of the Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Union, Mike Sullivan. Thanks for your time, Mike.
Thank you.
Mike, your foundation got the ball rolling to get this documentary made. In short, why do you think that the story of Eugene Debs needs to be told?
Well, it's practical to what's going on in our society today. I see it as a way of getting out the message of what Debs did might be able to be done so that people can see the relationship between then and now and our society and how people work and what families need.
Do you think this is the time, or has it always been the time to learn about Debs? I just wonder if the timing is right.
I think the timing's appropriate right now. It should have been done before. I started studying Debs in the mid-70s and thought that people should know about his life, especially being from Indiana, being born in Indiana, raised in Indiana, and seeing that no one knew anything about him in school. I never heard about Debs in going all through school, studied Indiana history, never heard the word Eugene V. Debs mentioned by anyone. So after I began to read about him and know more about him, I thought that his story should be told.
Mike Sullivan, you're the 2000 recipient of the Eugene V. Debs Award, and you're in some pretty famous company. Kurt Vonnegut, Ralph Nader, Coretta Scott King, among many others. What did that award mean to you?
Well, it meant a lot, but I have to say that I never felt that I deserved it. Those people for sure have I don't feel that I deserved it. It was a great honor. It was the highlight of my career as far as awards. It was one of those things that touched me, touched my heart, because I knew Debs's story, and to be a part of that was very rewarding.
Well, and since then, you served for a while as the president of the Eugene V. Debs Foundation. How long was that term?
I couldn't tell you the exact number of years. It was quite a few years, and it was after 2000. I gave the position up in 2011 when I retired. I felt like there ought to be a full-time person involved in the labor movement as a part of being the president of the foundation.
And as the head of that foundation, you had a hand in determining who gets that award. What does that award mean? How did you select the candidates, the people who got it?
Well, actually, I didn't.
You didn't?
No. The people that were involved were the board members, and they made that decision. The presidency, when I was there, was sort of a leadership position that was by name only, and it offered the ability for people to participate from the people that I knew and could promote the foundation.
So, but I guess I'll ask again, what does it mean to get that award? How, what kind of a person do you have to be? What kind of a platform should you be on?
Well, I think you have to be a progressive. You have to be sincere at what you do. I think you have to have some moral content. I believe that you need to be know about Debs and have a feeling for Debs and have done something that the committee thinks is above and beyond what a normal person would do in their daily lives.
Fred Nation, you have lived in Terre Haute a long time. You ran for mayor once. You went to the went to ISU in the 60s, and you were there. And when you were there, you were introduced to the work of Eugene Debs through your academic advisor. How did that sort of change the course of your life?
Well, that's correct. I was a history major, and J. Robert Constantine, who was the longtime secretary and one of the founders of the Eugene B. Debs Foundation, was my advisor, and he offered me a student assistantship. So I was, I think it was 1963 or 64, and the Debs home had just opened. And I cataloged old socialist books and labor books. And, you know, it opened my eyes to a lot of subjects that I really hadn't, didn't have much knowledge about before. Of course, as a history major, it was something I was interested in. And so consequently, I became kind of a Debs hobbyist on and off throughout my life.
You said you kind of got involved in the mid-60s. This was sort of right after the Debs home. And this is just a curiosity for me. This is sort of right after the Debs home was a fraternity house for over a decade, right? The Theta Chi fraternity house. What condition was the house in when you stepped in?
That's correct. It was. It had been a fraternity house in its last iteration after Mrs. Catherine Debs died. I did not see the house before it became the Debs home. That is, I wasn't inside of it. When I started, it had already been... it was in a restoration mode. It was open as a home, but you know, I would imagine it had its wear and tear as a fraternity house.
Debs still remains a controversial figure to some people. Terre Haute and Vigo County in particular are very much a split down the middle kind of town politically. It's historically the best bellwether town in the nation for determining presidential elections. What do people in town have to say about Debs today?
You know, it's. I think you described it well. It's split. There are probably an increasing number of people becoming aware of him because of the attention that the socialist party, or Democratic Socialist Movement, is getting right now, and of course the charges that all the Democrats or socialists are going to lead us to some crazy society that we hear all the time. But Debs inspires a lot of people here. He, because the home is on the campus of Indiana State University, the archives are at the Indiana State University Library. There's been a little more interest in recent years. Debs for years was blamed unfairly and unduly for Terre Haute's lack of economic progress. That's pretty well gone away. And those who, because of the Debs Foundation annual dinners here, that's helped educate a lot of people to the accomplishments which you covered earlier in your show.
Mike Sullivan, let's talk about socialism, which is an idea that makes some people very concerned. From your perspective and with respect to the legacy of Eugene Debs, what do you want people to know about socialism?
Well, socialism is about social justice. It's about equality of people. It is about freedom of speech without being chastised for your opinions. It's about treating people equally. It's about raising living standards. It's about having the government be involved to make life better for working people and all of America. It's, you know, we hear so much about socialism, but we never hear about unbridled capitalism. And what we have in our nation is we swing from place to place. And under Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, we became more socialistic. A lot of programs came into effect. After that, we had the Red Scare, and people moved away from that, and capitalism became the center of progress in our nation, not thinking about the people at the bottom or the people in the middle. So what socialism does for me is it's – and the reason that I came to socialism was two reasons. I believe in social justice. But also, as a Christian man, Debs defined socialism as Christianity in action. And I believe that. It's about helping our brothers and lifting that ship. And as it rises, everyone rises with it.
And I hear all that, and that's sort of the sunny picture of socialism. But its critics say that it's an idea that removes the incentives for innovation and entrepreneurship, among other things. And they say it could fundamentally change society and the economy in ways that we really wouldn't want. How do you respond to that?
Well, I say that that's not true. American socialism, and as Deb said, American socialism will develop into its own. It won't be socialism, Russian socialism, German socialism, European socialism. It will develop into its own. And it has. If you look at what we have in our society today, public education is socialism. Workers' compensation, fire departments, police departments, the U.S. military, anything that's being paid by tax dollars is a part of socialism. It is a socialistic program. That is what socialism is to me. I can't believe that anyone would want people not to have to work to make a living and to do their part. But people shouldn't be held down by people with money, a few, and not allowed to that golden opportunity to achieve whatever they desire or whatever they're capable of desiring by hard work and through education and knowledge. And that's what unbridled capitalism does. It pushes people down, whereas socialism tries to bring them up. And we never, you know, we're unwilling to discuss the debate about unbridled capitalism, what capitalism, the harm that total capitalism can do to a society. That capitalism with no regulation creates aristocracy. And that is one of the things in our country was founded on, not having an aristocracy. And we have one in this nation today, in my opinion. So to me, it is possible for capitalism and socialism to work together for the betterment of all.
But at the same time, Republicans won over working people in the 2016 election, and they sort of use socialism as a rallying cry against what might happen if someone like Bernie Sanders, a self-described democratic socialist, were to be elected president. These are real concerns held by a lot of Americans. How do you think then that the president got working people on his side in that way, and what's your response to that?
Well, I think he used issues that were because people weren't doing as well. When you don't have a piece of the pie, you want a piece of the pie. And what he used was what, and you blame others for that. And what our president, I believe, has successfully done has used the issue of people not people crossing the borders illegally, immigration. You know, immigration was used in as a tool to get elected when Debs was alive. And what he did it was Irish immigrants, Italian immigrants, Polish immigrants, German immigrants. They've all suffered discrimination when they first came to this nation. Now it's Hispanic immigrants that we're so concerned about. And when you take an issue and focus on it and people buy into that issue, then, of course, you can sway them on on many things.
And Mike Sullivan, in the last minute we have, what is the modern labor movement fighting for now that might be the equivalent controversy-wise to what Debs fought for back in the late 1800s, early part of the 20th century?
The right to organize.
The right to organize?
Yes.
And can you expound upon that?
Yes. I mean, the laws were...
You're talking about like right to work and things like that.
Yes,
that are sort of an issue today.
Right. Just take right to work for an issue today. In Indiana, when we passed the right to work law, people got on, politicians got on television and said that unions don't have to represent those people that don't want to belong to a union. But that's totally untrue. The National Labor Relations Act says we have to represent them even if they don't pay dues, if they're not members. Well, there's nothing in our society that does anything like that or allows anything like that. Right to work is an issue. Minimum wage is an issue. Workers' right to stand up and be challenged and say their opinion without being... their right to strike without being chastised over that.
The film is The Revolutionist, Eugene V. Debs. Its premiere is tomorrow night at 7 in University Hall Theater on the ISU campus. Its television premiere is a week from tonight on WFYI-1. I want to thank you both for your time this afternoon, former president of the Debs Foundation, Mike Sullivan, and former mayor of Terre Haute, former mayoral candidate of Terre Haute, Fred Nation. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it later today on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And I'm excited to announce that All In is about to become a daily show starting Monday, September 30th. We'll be 5 days a week at this time on WFYI. And in addition, we'll also be carried on public radio stations throughout Indiana. So we hope that you'll keep joining us weekday afternoons or anytime on the podcast. We're committed to being your daily dose of issues and interests that are strictly and distinctly Indiana. And you can help us out by simply being right where you are right now, tuned in or streaming us in whatever way you choose. Our producers are Maggie Galon, Drew Dodlin, and myself. Our managing editor is Scott Cameron. Technical directors Chris Flood and Adam Gross. A big thanks to our engineering and IT staff who've worked tirelessly to get this thing ready for Monday's launch. Steve Jensen, Al Grossenkloss, our Brian Childs, Tim Rohrman, and John Hengisbach. And I'd be remiss if I didn't thank the most important person on Membership Week, and that would be you. Thank you for your support of public radio. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.